Happy Europe Day, everyone. Welcome to the Foreign Policy Talks Europe Day special episode. For this interview, we'll bring to you the candid and exclusive conversation with the ambassadors of the European Union member countries. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, the listeners of Foreign Policy Talks podcast. Thank you so much for being the loyal listeners of this platform. And as always, I will bring to you a lot of interesting experts, figures that can share to you about any most pressing international issues today. And today, I'm very humbled and honored of having Ambassador Vincent Piket, the Ambassador of EU to Indonesia and Brunei Darussalam. Before I give him a lot of questions that you have told me to ask him earlier, let me greet him. How are you doing, Ambassador?
Very well, thanks. Thanks indeed, and good to see you once again.
Yes, it's good to see you too. Happy Europe Day, Ambassador, by the way. I know it's in the midst of this geopolitical problems everywhere in the parts of, across the globe. It's good to reflect what is the meaning of Europe Day to you and also to European Union, especially in what ways you celebrate peace and unity in the midst of global circumstances today?
Well, I think the global circumstances make that this Europe Day 2022 even more special than it is normally for us. And because with Europe Day, we celebrate the creation of a zone of peace, stability, and prosperity in an ever larger union of sovereign countries who have decided voluntarily to join this union and to help construct it further. And this has been a long process. It's not overnight. We see 1957 as the birth year of the European Union. So we're now a good 65 years down the road, and we have continued to evolve. I personally, of course, as a citizen of Europe, I've seen it happen. I personally remember very well how we still had customs borders between member states, how we had land borders, internal borders, and so each little trip from the Netherlands, where I grew up, to Germany or Belgium required documents and paperwork if you had anything to transport. And all that's gone. Also because we have, thanks to the internal borders dismantlement, we have now a passport-free zone of travel all the way from the very top of Sweden and Finland down to Portugal, Spain, Greece, Cyprus, and Malta. So, and that is something that I think every European citizen values and treasures. We enjoy it every summer when we go abroad for our holidays. We enjoy the benefits, these very practical benefits of the European Union, supported by hosts of other, achievements that we've got. For instance, the euro, no need to change money from one country to the next and to worry whether you have enough of the currency of the country where you're in. Roaming, we have abolished roaming charges between the member states. So if you travel abroad during your holiday and you use, you do everything except downloading large movies, you can freely use your social media and at no extra cost. And that is great for the European citizen, especially for young people, of course. They like their social media, they communicate with their friends and tell them where they are and what they eat. So that is for me Europe, the sense of liberty that it has created for individual citizens and in a peaceful and stable and prosperous zone. Politics is real at the moment, of course, and it the war in Ukraine does remind me very much of the fall of the Iron Curtain back in 1989. We were glued to the television when it happened, and we saw how the Berlin Wall was being demolished by citizens after a period of occupation and lack of freedom in the eastern part of Berlin, for instance, and that has been a pivotal moment for Europe, particularly, and we're reminded of that moment, especially today with the violence and the war in Ukraine. Yeah. So that's what I would say. That's what we celebrate on Europe Day: peace, stability, freedom for citizens, and a zone where people can develop their talents, their skills, and build happy lives.
Wow, interesting, Ambassador. So basically, Europe Day reminds the people in Europe about their high sense of belonging to the region, yeah, and how they can contribute to peace and stability in many ways, the integration as well that you mentioned earlier. But Ambassador, as you know, since the onset of COVID pandemic, all regional bodies or institutions, include EU, ASEAN, and many parts of the globe, have challenged by, you know, there is a crisis that they need to respond together, but you know, there are problem of nationalism, there are problem of insolidarity because they take care of their own countries, right? Would you mind sharing about the EU experiences in this regard? How EU as a region can work together to battle the crisis, and probably the listeners wants to listen as a good lesson learned from them.
Yes, well, you have to start answering the question by being honest and by saying that the COVID pandemic took us by surprise. Yep. And the European Union, despite our good health systems and so on, we were unprepared. And the initial reactions of member states were reactions that concentrated solely on the needs and the urgency of work at home, understandable, but of course in an integrated Europe, it's not enough. So we were unprepared, but I think that we got on top of the crisis rather quickly. There was a strong sense soon that we had to act together. On a number of fronts, emergency aid, the sharing of face masks and other equipment, the treatment of sick people across borders in countries where there was hospital capacity, etc. We brought home from outside Europe European citizens that had been stranded by the pandemic abroad. So there were a good 800,000 Europeans brought home by joint evacuation or repatriation flights. The civil air system was down, evidently. So these were examples of action in the first instance. Subsequently, we started looking at vaccines, and we decided as EU that we wished to pool our purchasing of vaccines instead of competing with one another on the global market. We bought vaccines together. The European Commission that did so on behalf of the member states, and that has worked pretty well, both on the European continent, our own countries, but also for third countries, for our vaccine donations to third countries. And I think we can be quite proud of what we've done, that essentially we have deployed as many vaccines abroad outside the EU as we have used inside the EU, and particularly, of course, for the lower income countries. Another important tool for citizens and was the our joint digital vaccination certificate, which was introduced early last year. And I can tell you this, I've experienced it myself in the summer of 2021. It helped us cross borders without trouble. And it gave us back the freedom for travel that we had temporarily lost in the EU. So I think it's a good example of how cooperation amongst sovereign countries within the European Union can create positive results for all of us. By the way, not just for the EU citizens, yep, in Europe, but also for the foreign citizens resident in Europe, they enjoy the very same benefits. Now, of course, we are in the recovery mode. We've done pretty well economically after the crisis, the pandemic receded with very good growth rates across the board, which have allowed all member states and the EU as a whole to return to the pre-crisis, pre-pandemic level of GDP very quickly and go beyond it. So that's great. We see now the hiccup of the war in Ukraine that causes tremendous economic concerns. The IMF calculated it last week that the world had lost 1.6 percentage points of GDP growth as a result of the war. And of course, in Europe, being on the border of Ukraine, is the one to suffer most in general, but particularly also because of the commodity and the energy prices. So that is something that is of serious concern for us, because it causes inflation, which is far too high, and it creates uncertainty in our economy because of our energy dependence at present on Russia. So that is something we're focusing on right now.
Right. That's impressive, Ambassador. And it really reflects how EU efforts is really meaningful, not only for the EU citizens, as you said earlier, but also for the global citizens, for the global recovery, right? And especially for least developing economies, and how actually EU can and actually help them in terms of vaccine, in terms of the medicine supplies and so on and so forth. But I'd like to follow up on your last point, Ambassador, about economy. So as you know, that COVID has disrupted the state and development of our global economy. And I saw there are a lot of initiatives coming up since then to help the world to swiftly recover from the pandemic. Because you're ambassador to Indonesia, and most of the listeners also coming from Indonesia, would you mind to share about any initiatives that you're running now to help Indonesia and EU to together recover economically?
Certainly. The EU has responded and helped Indonesia with a sizable package of COVID assistance, 200 million euros in total. 20 million euros are in grants for the work of the World Health Organization here in Indonesia. Secondly, also many grants for civil society organizations around Indonesia and the different islands from Java, Sumatra to east and west, Nusa Tenggara and Sulawesi. NGOs that worked for especially for the vulnerable people, the poor people, low income groups, disabled persons, special position of children and women, small SMEs in the rural economy. You can easily imagine how difficult a time they had as a result of the economy, and we were able to render support to them very, very quickly. Now we are looking to promoting the overall economic recovery for Indonesia. First of all, we want to have always wanted to continue to be a loyal and trustworthy trade partner for Indonesia. Our borders have always been open for trade and with Indonesia, and we've seen that after the serious dip in trade, global trade, but also bilateral trade in 2020, 2021 again saw an increase in Indonesian exports to the EU. And so we are not yet totally back where we were in 2019, but we will, normally speaking, be getting there this year. The second thing is that we want to work with Indonesia on investment, on boosting investment in two ways. First of all, negotiate our big free trade agreement with Indonesia, the SEPA, Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, covers trade as well as investment. And that is something that for the long run will bring jobs and growth for Indonesia. We've calculated all of that in macroeconomic studies, and for Indonesia, it will be very, very positive once we have the agreement and once it is at cruising speed, so to say. Secondly, it's about investment in the real sense, and that is to say, promote European businesses coming here and set up shop and with lending from the development banks of the EU, the European Investment Bank, but also of the development banks of the EU member states, especially Germany and France. They are big players here on the market, and they do make a difference. And the good thing about investment, European investment in Indonesia, is that we don't come just with a bag of money, but we come with know-how, we've come with our way of doing business with high standards if it comes to the environment and the sustainability of our production processes and so on, and we come with high standards as regards to labor conditions and the job protection, job promotion for the local workers. So that, I think, goes beyond the monetary value of the investment, and certainly is something that helps the sustainable development, sustainable growth of Indonesia to move ahead.
Right, that's interesting. You touch on the inclusive and a sustainable value of our economic growth. And that's actually the main theme or values that have been promoted by Indonesia to its G20 presidency. And I'm curious to know, how do you see this G20 Indonesian leadership, and what does actually the EU expect from this presidency this year?
Well, first of all, of course, the G20 presidency is a wonderful opportunity for Indonesia. It's a recognition of where the country has moved over the past 10, 12 years as a fast emerging economy, a large economy, a large population with weight in the world, and particularly now we see that reflected in the role as presidency of the G20. We support that role very, very much. We want to help Indonesia build a success and to really shine on the world stage in economic and other policy making. So full support. What we particularly value is the opportunity and the need for reflection amongst the G20 countries about how to push forward sustainable recovery. And Indonesia, from our point of view, has set the right sort of priorities for that. First of all, learning from the pandemic, we must be prepared, better prepared for a next pandemic, if and when, or even as and when it happens. So Indonesia's drive to set up a scheme for resilience against future pandemics is something we support very much. Secondly, it's about the green recovery, the sustainable recovery. We've always said that okay, we need to come back and build back our economy after the pandemic, but the pandemic crisis is one, but the climate crisis is another one, and we can't ignore it. So as we move out of the dark days of the pandemic, we must invest in a green recovery. And we see that priority also reflected in the Indonesian priorities, with a strong emphasis on boosting especially the energy transition. I think by now, all countries around the world, and especially the G20 leaders, recognize that boosting the renewable energy sector and transitioning out of the dependence on fossil fuels, oil, coal, and gas, is a must. The climate science tells us that very, very clearly. We must do that. And Indonesia wishes to make a tremendous boost to that drive in its presidency, and we support it both in policy terms, and also we will support it with finance. And the last topic, if I may, it's the digital economy. Now, you and I live in Indonesia. We see how fast the digital economy is growing in this country. It's really fascinating. There's more than in development than I can keep up with, but it just goes to show that development and growth in an emerging economy like Indonesia's can go very, very fast and can help accelerate sustainability and growth across the nation. And I think for that reason, particularly, the EU is attached to this priority of Indonesia's presidency, boosting the digital economy, creating an equitable space for the big operators to work in, and secondly, creating a safe space for the use of the digital tools, the social media, to protect our data and our privacy and so on. And here, I think I can say that the EU is leading the world if it comes to regulation of the digital economy and of individual rights. We have just agreed in the EU the new digital market legislation and the digital services legislation, covering both competition and the creating possibilities for young startups to come into the market, despite the presence of the big ones we all know, and secondly also putting in place rules that the digital services providers must comply with to protect individual rights of users. And so we will be bringing that know-how to the table of the G20 for other members to share with us.
Right. So as you know, Ambassador, President Jokowi doesn't want to see G20 is only a talking form, but we can listen all from you that EU is ready to bring tangible and actionable outcomes from G20 together with Indonesia. And that's, it's good to hear. But Ambassador, as you know, we are facing a critical geopolitical crisis given to the Ukraine-Russia war, and it's not affecting only in people in Europe or countries in Europe, but also in many parts of the globe, including Indonesia and its G20 presidency. But how will you as an EU see this crisis and how to promote a peace actually and put this conflict to an end, Ambassador?
Well, the first observation, of course, is that what we're facing now with Russia's war in Ukraine is a major violation of the international set of rules, the UN Charter and the sovereignty rules that all of us should abide by. It's an unprovoked attack. It's an illegal attack against a sovereign country. And which explains why 140 countries in the UN General Assembly voted in favor of a resolution condemning this. Yeah. And 140, so it shows you that there's something massive at stake here. Second thing I would say is that if you look at it from Indonesia, then I hear some people say, you know, this is happening 10,000 kilometers away, it doesn't concern us, and some a European conflict, and we can ignore it. That is patently not true. This does concern everybody, and including Indonesia. Not only because of the security risk for the global, the UN Charter and so on, but also because of the economy. We see it happen right now. This is hurting Indonesia's growth. This is hurting prices, causing inflation in Indonesia. This is causing shortages of commodities in Indonesia, and that is profoundly destabilizing for a country like Indonesia that has to move on for achieving its SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, by just a couple of years, 2030. Yep. So this is something nobody can ignore. And neither bilaterally, but also in multilateral platforms like the G20. Remember that the motto of Indonesia's presidency is recover together, recover stronger. Yeah. That's a great top motto. But right now, of course, we must recognize that there's one member in the G20 that is not together with us. It's against us, and it's harming us. It's waging a war that all of us are paying for. So something that is manifestly wrong and unjustified. And so our position is very strongly, and it's shared by 140 other countries, including Indonesia, is that this war must end. There has to be a ceasefire. There has to be a withdrawal of troops, Russian troops, from Ukrainian soil. And that should create a context, an atmosphere for negotiations for a durable solution which will be tough to negotiate. But the first step has to be taken and decided by the Kremlin, which started the war and which now must stop this war. The topic, the G20 is economic by nature, but as I, in my answer, I've sketched the war is unavoidable. We have to face it. It looks us in the eye, and we have to deal with the impacts of the war for all of us as individual G20 members, but also the world economy. Think about the food prices and the commodities. tremendous increase in prices, and they're bound to go up further the longer the war lasts. Now, who suffers most from that? Of course, everybody suffers, but most suffer the countries with the lower income groups in the developing world, in Africa in particular. So that is a hugely unfair to them, and something that hopefully will be averted by Russia ceasing the warfare in Ukraine and allowing the trade of commodities and foodstuffs to resume.
Right. And I think most importantly, there has to be an immediate peace in Ukraine, right, Ambassador, to the Ukrainian people. And I think I agree some of your points about G20. And allow me to ask you about this, Ambassador. What if Russia is attending the G20 Indonesia later on? And how do you think Indonesia should continue its presidency if the positions of many countries are still in their concerns about Russia's presence?
Well, I'm not going to sit on the presidency chair of Indonesia in answering that question, but I just want, what I can say is that the EU has said to our Indonesian partners that the G20 can't be business as usual. What was designed before the attack against Ukraine has to be modified and changed to focus on the reality, the new reality of the world, the economic and security reality that we now see. So business as usual is impossible. It will be very, very difficult for the EU leaders in the current situation to sit at the same table with President Putin. That was very, very difficult. You can imagine that. The finance ministers meeting of the G20 last week, held in the margin of the IMF meetings and so on in Washington, showed that very well. And so we have a very difficult situation for everybody, with a lot of goodwill, of course, from the European Union side and the member states who are part of the G20. A lot of goodwill towards Indonesia. We want to support the government in bringing this to a good resolution.
Right. Ambassador, move on to the topic that is the highlight of G20 Indonesia, which is energy transition and climate efforts. We know that EU is evidently the pioneer of climate movement and internationally, right? And many of EU member states are fans in terms of its climate mitigation, adaptation efforts, and tackling any effects of climate change so far. How do you envision a stronger EU-Indonesia relationship in terms of climate action, Ambassador?
I think that if you look at Indonesian policy development on climate, on environmental, and on sustainability over the past year, then we have seen a lot of movement and positive movement. Even before the big climate meeting in Glasgow, the COP26 in November. There is a much better basis for mutual engagement between Indonesia and us now, a stronger basis, and we will want to pick that up. And two big topics, of course, for Indonesia. One is energy. The share of renewables in the energy mix is still relatively low. It's growing, but probably not as fast as one might wish. And so we can help as EU by sharing our know-how on how we have done that, while how we have, by a mix of legislation and incentives, have pushed and promoted industry to green itself. And we've got tons and tons of know-how on this in the European Union, because it dates back 30 years or something like that, and we can make it available. For instance, how do you price carbon? What cost do you attach to carbon? And how do you charge companies and at the end of the day, customers in an equitable way for the carbon emissions that they produce? We have our emissions trading system. It has its weaknesses, it had its trouble, but the jury has certainly said that it's been the big game changer for a greening industry in Europe. We're going to expand our emissions trading system to more products, more sectors to be included in it, so that eventually we can generalize that to the entire European economy. Pollution, big topic for Indonesia. The solid waste, the water, the plastic in the oceans, in the rivers. Dealing with plastic is a must for the whole of the countries, but especially, of course, for your touristic highlights, the islands, particularly Bali, of course, famous around the world. But the fact of the matter is that sometimes on the beaches there, you see a horrible, horrible mass of plastic, and that is something has to be done. So there also the EU has done a lot of work on dealing with plastic, on reducing plastic in consumption, in packaging, in products, and recycling plastic, and avoiding that it ends up in rivers, and from the rivers into the seas, and from the seas into the fish, and from the fish in back onto our plates. So it is a massive job, but it's something where the Europe, member states, and the EU have something to offer. If you look at investment, lastly, we want to step up our investment in green investment in renewables here in Indonesia. The big development banks of Germany, of France, are very active. I should mention, representing the EU, also the European Investment Bank, which has opened an office here in Jakarta to boost our lending to Indonesia, especially in renewable energy. We call the EIB, the European Investment Bank, our climate bank, and that tells you in very simple terms what we wish to do. And lastly, looking at the policy cooperation, multilateral, G20, we have already discussed. Secondly, of course, towards the end of this year, there will be the next big climate meeting, global climate meeting, happening in Egypt in December, and we look forward to talking very, very closely with Indonesia about target setting for that meeting on all the topics that I've mentioned, but also the one that I haven't yet mentioned, and that is the forest. Where Indonesia has a tremendous wealth of pure forest around your country. Deforestation trends are looking better now, considerably better than a decade ago. So there is a strong basis, and we hope to continue working with Indonesia in bringing deforestation to an end and making sure that we have sustainable biodiversity and forest situation in the country. In the same way as we are, by the way, we're building it up in Europe, we are going to plant 3 billion trees in Europe over the next 9 years, 8 years, the year 2030. So
you said 3 billion.
Pardon?
You said 3 billion, yeah? 3 billion.
3 trees. Billion. Wow. 3 billion trees. Why do we do that? Of course, trees capture carbon, which is one thing. Secondly, the sustainable forest management, the sustainable use of wood is good for reducing fossil fuels in our economy, whether it's for construction or for heating.
Right. I think you made a good point, Ambassador. Even though there are a lot of things have been achieved so far in terms of climate action, but there remain more rooms to open, right? Especially between EU and Indonesia in terms of promoting energy transition and also a fight against climate change. And I'd like to move on, Ambassador. I know you're very busy, but many of our listeners are young foreign policy enthusiasts, Ambassador, and they've been questioning to me, like, what, you know, what you mentioned is most into the G2G level, maybe business level in terms of investment, technology, and finance. But where is the people part here? The younger generation. What exactly we can do in helping EU and Indonesia to grow together?
Well, first of all, to the young people, I would say that trade and investment and jobs are very, very much relevant to everybody, including to the young. Every year, Indonesia produces millions of new people entering the labor market, and we all need to make sure that you find jobs, and trade and investment help create them. Our companies invest here in local employment. We don't bring our employees from staff from Europe. The European firms will be looking for employees here in the Indonesian market. Secondly, if you talk about people-to-people cooperation, then of course we have a number of activities in education. The member states of the EU have individual scholarship schemes, which are run by their embassies here in Jakarta. The European Union has the large Erasmus program, which every year gives grants to Indonesian students. Is it enough? No, it is not enough, unfortunately. The demand and the interest is tremendous, and we just don't have enough money. But fortunately, and that's some very positive thing I can mention, that as of last year, the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Finance have decided to co-finance exchanges with the EU, parallel or totally interlinked with the Erasmus scheme. So we have created more capacity. Every year we organize the European Higher Education Fair. In the past, before COVID, we used to do that in big convention centers. Now we do it predominantly virtual, and you know that's a pity in a sense, but it's also good because it has it means that we can reach out to many, many more people than we used to, and explain what the opportunities are in Europe. That inform them that wherever you go, in whichever member state, you will find higher education university programs that are in English, so that they're totally accessible for Indonesian students. So that is great. And on top of that, you learn your your first lessons in French or Portuguese or Greek or Polish as a cultural experience for you. So that is certainly something we want to further develop. And lastly, I mean, for young people is activities like this podcast. We know how much young people like to listen to debates, to speakers from outside, and so working with social media, with think tanks, with universities is a priority for us. Wherever I go, wherever I travel in Indonesia, I always make it a point to knock on the door of one university there and to meet with professors, lecturers, but also to meet with a group of students and have a discussion about topics that matter for the EU, topic that matters for Indonesia, but also bilateral topics and global topics. So that is very much part of our intellectual outreach, if you like, to young people in Indonesia as well.
Wow, it's impressive, Ambassador, and I can't wait to see more youth-to-youth cooperation between EU and Indonesia. And Ambassador, we talked a lot about heavy and important topics just now, but would you mind if I ask you about your impression on Indonesia? I'm sure you've been traveling a lot of places in Indonesia, although the pandemic stopped you for a while, like about 2 years, right? But do you mind sharing any interesting places while you're traveling across Indonesia?
Oh, that's a very difficult one. Because
maybe the most difficult one.
Yeah, your country is so huge, and so I've seen something of it, but certainly it's only a tiny speck on your vast nation, and places in Indonesia, they are so diverse and they all have their attractions in different ways. I've been, of course, in Java I've traveled around a fair bit, on the western tip of Java Island, looking at the Anak Krakatau, which is now active, showing activity, and which is, it's fascinating to see that part of Indonesia, the south of Java, of course, with Yogyakarta as a world class jewel, cultural jewel, that is must be visited by whoever comes to your country. But also in Sumatra, I had a very, very exciting visit to Aceh, Banda Aceh, visiting the Tsunami Museum, which was very deeply, deeply impressive, and see how that city has recreated itself after the horrible disaster of 15 years ago. So that was very impressive. Going more to the east, wonderful visit to North Sulawesi, where we fund an activity for sustainable use of the marine environment, basically to help the fishing communities fish in a way that doesn't hurt the corals and the biodiversity. And so it was wonderful to visit these very tiny, tiny villages, of 300, 400, 500 people on the small islands up there in North Sulawesi, and then on the coast. Very interesting to speak to the people there through an interpreter. And I felt a connection there, and I felt that I felt the commitment of the people to work together to protect their local environment. So that was another experience in other parts of Sulawesi, Southeast Sulawesi, a wonderful place to visit, so rich in biodiversity and culture. I've collected quite some different kinds of batik while traveling around, and every region has its own style, and you need to get to know it a little bit, and it's not visible at first sight, but as you travel, you get to see the differences and the distinctive features of batiks here on Java, but also in Bali, etc. And so, but lastly, I would say there's so much to discover, as for me, still in this wonderful country, and your landscapes, your shores, your islands, your cultures. And I look forward to that very, very much now that the COVID pandemic has receded.
Yeah. You know what, while you're sharing this story, I'm imagining how beautiful the places are, and I'm sure the listeners are doing the same way. And we can't wait to have a holiday coming soon, next week. Yeah, it's next week. Yeah. And thank you so much, Ambassador, for your time. And thank you for sharing the knowledge, thoughts of you about EU-Indonesia relationships, but also the most pressing issues that we have today. And can't wait to have a stronger EU-Indonesia relationships. And I think young people, the listeners of this podcast, are ready to help and to contribute, to take part of this efforts. And thank you, Ambassador.
Thank you all the same. Take care. Bye. All the best.
Thank you, everyone, for listening all the way to the end. Follow Foreign Policy Talks on Instagram at Foreign Policy Talks to keep updated. Feel free to comment your thoughts on this Europe Day special episode on our Instagram. And don't forget to check the quiz that we're going to have, especially for the celebration of peace and unity in this Europe Day. Thank you, and stay tuned for the next episodes.